Chapter 43 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 43. After I had finally disposed of Ross and established my plea of justification against him, followed the long series of appearances in the Chancery Court, culminating in the incident I have already described, when I washed my hands of my son. A period of 2 years then elapsed, in which very little happened. I was living with my mother in a charming house called Shelley's Folly, 3 miles from Lewes, belonging to Lord Monkbreton. I did nothing but read Catholic books, Lives of the Saints, St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas. I read the whole Summa Theologica, St. Teresa, St. Catherine of Siena, and so forth. My life on the whole was quite uneventful. I had made another unsuccessful attempt to go to war, directly after I defeated Ross. I wrote to Kitchener again, pointing out that I had now emerged from all my legal difficulties and that I had justified my libels on Ross, and asking him now to give me a commission or let me go as an interpreter. He replied, saying practically the same as he had said before. I was in my 44th year when the war broke out, and as I had never been in the army, or even in the militia or volunteers, I had of course no special qualification. I am very glad now that I did not go to the war, but at the time it was a grievance. Beyond a little snipe and duck shooting up in Caithnessshire, which was the nearest I could get during the war to the snipe bogs of the Orkney Islands, where I have a standing invitation to go and shoot with my old and valued friend Mr. Reagan, I did nothing but read and take long walks, with an occasional ride at Newmarket or elsewhere. In this period I wrote and published The Rossiad and Eve and the Serpent. The only unusual incident that occurred was a visit to Mr. Herbert Moore Pym, the Irish poet, who was then editing a paper called The Irishman. I went to stay as his guest at a charming cottage he had near Dunmurry, and remained several weeks. Mr. Pym, who was afterwards my assistant editor on Plain English, which was, I suppose, more anti-Sinn Féin than any other paper in London in 1920-1921, was at that time an ardent Sinn Féiner, and ran the Irishman in that interest. In fact, he claims with Griffiths to have started the Sinn Féin movement. When the Sinn Féiners started murdering people, cutting off the noses of donkeys, and dragging the Catholic Church in the mire for political ends, Pym revolted and left them. He ended by being as violently anti as he had been before pro-Sinn Féin. At the time when, some years later, I telegraphed to him and asked him to come to London and be my assistant editor in Plain English, he had been warned that he was going to be murdered, and the police had informed him that they were powerless to protect him. Pym, of course, is a Catholic, a convert, though he comes of Ulster Protestant stock, his uncle being Mr. Justice Pym. When I was at Pym's, I read The Jail Journal by John Mitchell. It greatly impressed me, and I became very sympathetic to the Irish nationalist movement. When I started Plain English, I was still in sympathy with the movement, but as a Catholic, I soon revolted against the campaign of murder and lying which was carried on by the Sinn Féiners, and as I got all my information on the Irish question from Pym, I soon followed him in his change of views. But all this was 3 or 4 years after the time of which I am speaking, when I stayed with Pym and wrote in The Irishman. I greatly admired some of Pym's poetry written about this time. What he has written since seems to me to be nothing like so good. Just before this time I had first met my great friend Mr. Sawley Brown, the editor of the Border Standard, Crossland's biographer. He stayed as my mother's guest in a house at Hove, and we have since exchanged numerous visits in Galashiels and London. I can never sufficiently thank Mr. Sawley Brown for all his chivalrous defence of me in that part of my native Scotland which is still sometimes called the Douglas Country. Then came the Pemberton Billing case, in which I was asked to give evidence for Mr. Billing. I did so, and I helped to secure his acquittal at the Old Bailey, when he was tried on a charge of criminally libelling Miss Maud Allen, Maud Allen being, however, as I immediately realised, only a stalking horse for forces which I recognised as belonging to what I call the Ross Gang view of life. This trial brought me into great prominence owing to the fight I had from the witness box with Mr. Justice Darling. After the ransom case, I had written to Mr. Justice Darling, telling him that the only reason I had not answered him as he deserved to be answered, when he attacked and bullied me in that case, was that I was bound by a promise, given on my word of honour to my counsel, Mr. Cecil Hayes, that I would not attack the judge, however great the provocation. In this letter I said to Mr. Justice Darling, "If ever I come before you again, as I pray God I may, you will see what will happen to you." I have no intention of retailing all this business again in detail. It was fully reported in the papers. Mr. Justice Darling tried to repeat the tactics with me which he had used in the ransom case, but on this occasion I was not bound by any promise, and I was free not only to defend myself, but to carry the war into the enemy's camp. My methods were entirely successful, for after a duel lasting about 5 minutes, during which Mr. Justice Darling threatened to have me removed from the court, he gave up the struggle, and left me to give my evidence exactly as I chose to give it. Later he made certain remarks about me in his summing up, and I rose to my feet in the body of the court and called him a damned liar, a remark which was received with a perfect tornado of cheers and hand-clapping, lasting for several minutes, under cover of which I discreetly retired. It has often been wondered why Mr. Justice Darling did not commit me to prison for contempt of court on this occasion. Well, I called him a damned liar, and if he had committed me for contempt, the question must ultimately have arisen of exactly what were the words he had used, which I had stigmatised as lying words. The shorthand report of his summing-up speech would have shown exactly what he said, and the question would have arisen as to whether it was true or not. Well, it was not true, and Mr. Justice Darling knew it was not true. So that explains why Mr. Justice Darling was not taking any more risks with me. When I left the court after the verdict in this case, I was loudly cheered by a crowd of several thousand people outside the Old Bailey. Several years later, when my case against the Evening News was in the list, I was informed by my solicitor that it was coming on a certain day next week, and that it was to be tried by Mr. Justice Darling. I immediately took a cab to the law courts, sent in my card to the associate, the official who settles the order of cases and arranges what judge shall take what case, and asked if I might see him. He came out to see me in the corridor of the courts, and asked me stiffly what I wanted. I told him that I had been informed that Mr. Justice Darling was to take my case against the Evening News. He said, "Yes, that is so." I said, "Well, I refuse to have my case tried by Mr. Justice Darling, and if he attempts to try it, I will make such a row as has never been heard before in the law courts." He said, "What is your objection to Mr. Justice Darling?" I then said that I did not wish to say a word against Mr. Justice Darling, and that no doubt his intention would be to give the case a fair trial, but, I said, in view of what happened in the Billing case, is it conceivable that he will not be prejudiced against me? And in any case, surely he would not wish to try a case in which I am concerned, if he knows that I strongly object and want the case to be tried by some other judge. Why, I went on, should this one judge of all others be selected to try this particular case? This was so reasonable that the associate was bound to admit the force of what I said. His reply was, "There are only three judges on the rota at present, and Mr. Justice Darling happened to be the one selected for your case. But in view of what you say, we will give you Mr. Justice Bray instead." I said, "No thanks, I won't have Bray either." This tickled the associate so much that he began to laugh. He said, "Why, what is the matter with Mr. Justice Bray?" I then explained that he had tried the case in which Crossland was non-suited when he sued Ross for malicious prosecution, and that in the course of his remarks he had attacked me most unjustifiably when I was not there to defend myself, and that I had written and circulated all over the bench and bar a sonnet about him, the last line of which was, "And down the ages, Bray and Bray and Bray." The sonnet appears in my Collected Satires, published by the Fortune Press in 1926. The smiling associate said, "Well, you know, Lord Alfred, litigants are not supposed to come here and choose their own judges. But may I ask what judge would suit you?" I replied, "Oh, I don't mind the Lord Chief Justice." He was the third judge on the rota. "Very well, then," said the associate. "We will give you the Lord Chief Justice." I thanked him and withdrew, but next week my case was taken out of the list and put on right after the long vacation, when it ultimately came before Mr. Justice Horridge, and I won it easily, as I have already related. In 1919 my collected poems was published by Mr. Martin Secker. The volume is now out of print, and a new collected poems, which include In Excelsis and other poems, will be shortly brought out. The sale of my poetry, which has been the reprinting again and again of stuff I wrote 30 or more years ago, with a few additions from time to time, has now run into a good many thousand volumes. In addition to that, my poems have been extensively pirated in America, and 1,000 copies were sold in France of the original volume Poems, with a French prose translation. My new collected edition will contain my light comic and nonsense verses, which have also gone on steadily selling for the last 20 or 30 years. Footnote. Since this was written, my complete poems has duly appeared. And footnote. Nothing more which would be of any general interest occurred during the 5 years when I was at Shelley's Folly, until I became the editor of a new paper called Plain English in 1920. End of chapter 43.